You're listening to Microbe Talk, the podcast from the Microbiology Society. I'm Laura, and today I'm here with Matt.
Hello. Now, you might be wondering why we're uploading another podcast so soon. This is the first episode of a new podcast series where we discuss microbiology in the news. Every month, in addition to our usual Microbe Talk episodes, we'll be discussing the times microbes and microbiologists have been on the TV, in the papers, and trending online.
A lot of the time when people think about newsworthy microbiology, the first thing that comes to mind is disease. But microbiology is so much more than that, and we want to spend some time talking about the ways microbiologists are contributing to all areas of science. We're going to take it in turns talking about some of our top picks of the month. We'll leave links to all of the stories in the podcast description below. And if you see anything you think should be included in next month's podcast, let us know by sending us an email or tag us on Twitter at microbiosoc. So let's get started.
So my first story this month is the news that boys in the UK will be given the HPV vaccine. For those who don't know, HPV stands for human papillomavirus. You probably know it because since 2008, the vaccine has been given to girls in school to protect against cervical cancer. But the virus doesn't just cause cervical cancer, but oral, throat, anal, and other cancers as well. The vaccine will be given to boys between the ages of 11 to 13, depending on which country in the UK you live in. And the vaccination programme is starting from the next school term in September.
So why are boys now being given the vaccine?
The vaccination programme so far has been hugely successful, with HPV infections reducing not just in girls but in boys as well, as the virus isn't being passed on to them. So the hope is that in giving the vaccine to the boys too, the infection rate will drop even further.
Yeah, I guess you can't really have very good herd immunity if only half of the population are being protected against the disease.
Yeah, exactly.
A piece in the Mail on Sunday discussed the rise in antifungal resistance in fungal pathogens. Diseases caused by fungal infections may be less common than those caused by bacteria, but the resulting health implications can be just as significant, especially in people with long-term health conditions like asthma or cystic fibrosis. The story begins by discussing the plight of NHS worker John, who has aspergillosis, a disease caused by inhaling mold spores, which then take hold in the lungs. Unfortunately, the fungus now growing in John's lungs is resistant to all known antifungal medicines, meaning he may never be free from his infection. The piece goes on to discuss the state of antifungal resistance in the UK and other people who are directly affected by fungal infections. According to the article, many antifungals are used widely in agriculture to prevent crops from rotting and to make flower bulbs in garden centres last longer. As with antibiotics, the more antifungals that are used, the more resistance there is in the fungal population. I think this piece by journalist Nick Fleming does a really great job of highlighting why we should be more responsible with our use of antimicrobials.
So that actually ties really well into my second story, which is also about fungus, but this fungus is the fungus that causes white nose syndrome in bats, and worryingly it's been discovered in Northern California. Since 2006, white nose syndrome has killed millions of bats in the USA. It's caused by a fungus called Pseudogymnoascus destructans, and gets its name from the white fungal growth that grows around the muzzles and wings of infected bats. It's incredibly dangerous to the bats as it causes them to wake up more frequently whilst they're hibernating, and then that makes them use up their fat reserves and often causes them to die. It's pretty deadly, and the disease has been known to kill 90 to 100% of the bats in an infected site. As bats usually produce only one offspring per year, it can take decades for populations to recover.
I can't believe it wakes them up. Imagine dying because you get woken up by something.
It's really sad. They're basically covered in a white growth around there. It's not like, it kind of looks kind of powdery, and then it gets on their wings and stuff. Because they live in such close proximity, it spreads really, really quickly. So the actual disease hasn't been seen yet, just the fungus, but as it's considered one of the deadliest wildlife diseases, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife are understandably concerned.
It's been seen in Northern California for the first time, but it's elsewhere in the USA. How widespread is it?
So it was first identified in New York in 2006, but by early 2018, it's been found in 33 USA states and 7 Canadian provinces.
I'm surprised that the California Department of Fish and Wildlife are that concerned about their bat populations.
So bats are incredibly ecologically important as they eat a huge number of mosquitoes and other insects, so they prevent the spread of disease and prevent crops from being eaten by other insects.
As we see an increase in viral diseases such as dengue and Zika, research into arboviruses is more important than ever. Arboviruses are viruses spread by arthropods, such as ticks, mosquitoes, and even crabs. Some of these viruses cause disease in humans, and understanding arboviruses and their vectors is essential in disease control. If you're involved in research into arboviruses or arthropods, join the Microbiology Society for the International Meeting on Arboviruses and Their Vectors. Our IMAV 2019 focus meeting will be taking place on September 5th and 6th at the University of Glasgow. To register or find out more, go to our website microbiologysociety.org/IMAV19. So moving away from fungi into bacteria, a strain of Salmonella resistant to last resort antibiotics has been found in the USA for the first time. Salmonella is a bacterium that can infect humans and usually causes food poisoning. In this case, it was a strain of Salmonella enterica, which can cause some really nasty gastrointestinal symptoms and causes over 90 million infections every year. There's been a lot of concern about the rising resistance to antimicrobials in Salmonella, and it's been named as a pathogen that urgently needs new antibiotics by the World Health Organization. This story is from a paper published in the Journal of Medical Microbiology this month, and is the first report of a Salmonella with a gene called MCR3.1 in the USA. Similar bacteria have been seen in Asia before, and this patient had travelled to China a few weeks before getting sick. So that's where the researchers think the bacteria probably came from.
The researchers found the bacteria during routine surveillance of stool samples from people who had suspected Salmonella infection. Apparently, this sample was collected in 2014, so it really highlights the importance of ongoing surveillance to monitor the spread of antimicrobial resistance. Similar bacteria have been seen in Asia before, and this patient had travelled to China a few weeks before getting sick, so that's where the researchers think the bacteria probably came from. The spread of MCR3.1 is really worrying because it can be traded from bacteria to bacteria and makes them resistant to an antibiotic called colistin. Colistin is usually used as a last resort antibiotic, and with bacteria becoming resistant to this drug as well, medical professionals are really running out of options to treat bacterial infections.
On the subject of antimicrobial resistance, researchers at the French National Institute of Health and Medical Research have found a potential new weapon. A toxin that's released by MRSA as it infects its host could be harnessed to kill even the strongest microbes. These new chemicals are a type of peptide, which is a short chain of amino acids, and have been called peptidomimetics. Two of these new chemicals have been deemed safe for testing, and in mice they've been able to kill off resistant forms of Staphylococcus aureus and Pseudomonas aeruginosa. One of the main issues with antibiotics is that they kill all bacteria, not just the pathogenic ones, so it can cause some serious side effects. Researchers were testing the drugs with doses 10 to 50 times higher than the effective dose without seeing side effects. The article went on to discuss the fact that it's incredibly expensive for pharmaceutical companies to create new antibiotics, so they generally tweak already existing drugs. To give more of an incentive, the UK government is trialling a new subscription approach to funding drug development, which would pay companies upfront for medicines based on their usefulness to the NHS rather than units sold.
Is this subscription approach relatively new then?
So they haven't rolled it out yet, just announced that there will be a trial and that it will be led by NHS England, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence and NHS Improvement. But it's all part of the UK government's plan to cut inappropriate antibiotic use and reduce drug-resistant infection.
Ah, what a great initiative. So that brings me on to the last story of the episode. In an attempt to debunk some of the myths surrounding home hygiene, the Royal Society for Public Health released a press release this month explaining that you cannot be too clean. They said the hygiene hypothesis is an outdated theory. The hypothesis suggests that being too clean during childhood causes your immune system to become overly sensitive, which can lead to allergies and autoimmune diseases. They went on to say that the confusion caused by the hygiene hypothesis could lead to the spread of disease. This is a really interesting story and has been covered widely over the course of the month. A lot of news outlets worked with Microbiology Society member Professor Sally Bloomfield from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine to encourage people to participate in hygienic behaviours to prevent the spread of disease. Sally has been researching the lasting impact the hygiene hypothesis has had and discussed some of her research at the Microbiology Society annual conference earlier this year. We had the chance to speak to her in April. Here's what she had to say.
During human evolution, microbes have actually evolved an essential role in developing our immune system. the microbes we need exposure to are not infections at all. They're not the childhood infections. They are the old friends microbes, which were around during hunter-gatherer times when our immune system was evolving. And it was those organisms that were the essential ones for forming part of our microbiome and through that regulating our immune system so that it doesn't overreact to things that it should not. The lack of exposure to these old friends microbes began to be linked with a whole range of different diseases, not just allergies, autoimmune disease, multiple sclerosis, inflammatory bowel disease, going on into diseases like obesity and type 2 diabetes and all those sort of things. So it's, you know, it's quite different from the hygiene hypothesis. The crowd infections, the so-called crowd infections, the measles and mumps and things that children suffer from, they evolved far too late. They only evolved when we began to live in enclosed communities where these infections could spread. It couldn't possibly be the infections, the childhood infections, which hygiene was developed to prevent. So it really isn't hygiene.
And that's all we've got time for this month. We hope you've enjoyed the episode. Let us know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget there are links to all of the stories we've been talking about in the podcast description below. Thanks for listening to Microbe Talk.